Welcome. This is Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM in the high desert of Placitas, New Mexico, truly the land of enchantment. This is kind of a what I'm going to call a backstage pass to the 35th annual Placitas Holiday Fine Arts and Craft Sale. And the featured artist this year, or depending on when you're hearing it, the year 2016, John and Nancy Couch. So this is the, as I say, the backstage pass, because now we're going to speak with them, not necessarily about the show, but about you guys. This is, you've been in the show for 35 years.
Yes, we have.
Now, there were, I think we discovered in a previous interview, there were about 20 artists in the first show?
About a dozen.
A dozen.
So not that many. It was pretty hand-picked.
Right.
And they were all local artists here in Placitas, mostly.
Well, when you got there and you set up, what were you all thinking? It's like, this is our big break, or... Because you probably hadn't done a lot of shows at that point 35 years ago.
Mm-mm.
You were... How long had you been a couple?
Probably pretty new... A year or so for that.
So this was just another step in the development of your relationship, and I shouldn't assume, but I'm gonna assume it was your art that brought you together.
Actually, no.
No, okay.
What brought us together was we were both members of a forestry workers cooperative, and this was a business that was owned by the workers. And we bid and worked contracts for the Forest Service doing reforestation. And so
I've never heard of such a thing.
It sort of died out, but for many years it was funded by the timber sales that the Forest Service did. That's how they got all their money to do their projects. And so there was a lot of money available. And we were members of this cooperative, like I said, and we met on top of a mountain at about 9,000 feet at this.
That's pretty romantic.
And up near Taos. And
were one of you getting ready to jump, or you were at the gorge, or no? It was a happy meeting.
It was a happy meeting. We were introduced to each other by a fellow worker who knew both of us, and he said, "Hey, you guys are both woodworkers. Why don't you work next to each other, and you can talk tools?" So we did, and we were planting trees and talking woodworking and stuff, and it sort of went from there to working together a lot, and then becoming romantically involved.
Yeah. I flip through the channels a lot when I'm like editing shows, so I see a lot of craft shows, and you know, cooking and quilting. I don't watch quilting so much, but a little bit sewing, just to see how all this stuff is made that you find at these wonderful shows. Woodworkers. These guys are like people who in high school took their car apart and put it back together again. They've got more tools than the entire craftsman department at Sears, so they can make one little niche in one kind of piece of wood, and they love talking to each other about this. I don't see that in the watercolor people or acrylics. They don't go, maybe they do and I'm just not around. You know, this brush I just got, it's just amazing. I don't hear that conversation, but with woodworkers I do. And so you probably had a lot to speak about.
We did, yeah.
And we were different with the woodworking that we each did. John totally used hand tools. Everything was hand. He didn't use any power tools. Now, me, I use power tools, so it was kind of different kinds of work. He was a carver.
Right.
He carved everything and did everything by hand. I did parquet work where I cut little tiny pieces from bigger pieces and formed them into geometric patterns. So it's kind of almost like the prisms.
Right.
Way back then, I was doing just like quilting, but with wood.
Would that also lead to inlay wood if you're cutting those little pieces?
I was. It was all inlaid. It was about. They were all about a quarter inch thick, and I would have thousands of pieces and forming them into little, all together into a big design.
I couldn't begin to think the patience it would take. It's almost. I don't want to. undersell medical people, but it's almost like brain surgery in a way. I mean, it's some of those we've seen all, you know, the great masters that did this kind of work, and the inlay almost looks like a photograph. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. So you were in the same space, as they say, but you were your finished products and how you got there were totally different.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Was there ever the discussion of, well, let's collaborate on something? You know, John, you don't want to use power tools, but maybe you could use battery powered instead of plug-in, kind of a compromise.
Well, when we were getting ready for the first holiday sale, we were each doing our own work, and Nancy was doing her beautiful parquet work, and I was doing carving, and she was also doing the stained glass work, and had gotten into the water prism. So I collaborated on putting the hardware on, the circles and S's and things like that. And that was our first collaboration. We went to the first holiday sale, and we did better with the water prisms than we did with our woodwork. So that was a message. Every year after that, there was less woodwork and more glass until finally there wasn't any more woodwork, and we were collaborating full-time on the glass.
So if you're artists, but you're also working artists, like any business, maybe you like making the wood better, but if that doesn't put food on the table, well, then you do the thing that does, that you also like doing.
That's right.
So before this magic moment atop the mountain in Taos, of which there are quite a few, that was probably pre-ski lift Taos, or were they there 35 years ago?
Well, this wasn't actually up at the ski valley. This was between Taos and Peñasco, and it was up at it was called by the Forest Service Top of the Pot, and that meant it was at the top of Pot Creek. There was an old mill on Pot Creek. It's in Ranchos de Taos, and that we were up at the end of the road, at, like I said, at 9,000 feet, and it was a spruce beetle kill. All the trees were dead, laying all over. The timber was piled up, and we had to crawl over and under the logs to plant our tree seedlings. And that was some fun.
I'll bet.
Well, any excuse the crew would say, oh, we don't want to work, and we'd go back to camp and start playing volleyball. So it was a whole
experience.
Yeah. Well, that was
we're camping together.
Sign of the times.
So, yeah.
And let's start with John. How did you get to the point in your life that you were geographically close enough to Taos? I guess in an awkward way, I'm going to say, what part of the country you hail from?
I came from California, and I got here by way of a friend who had moved to New Mexico, and he had been someone that I'd met in college, and he'd been involved with the Whole Earth Truck Store and the Whole Earth Catalog. You may remember that.
Oh, yes.
And
I didn't know that it's not around anymore.
Maybe it is, but this was back when Stuart Brand was doing it. And he had followed his guru out to New Mexico, who was Richard Alpert, later known as Ram Dass, who wrote that book, Be Here Now. And my friend was sort of a disciple of his, a devotee. And he kept writing me letters saying, come to New Mexico, it's great. So we packed up, came to New Mexico. He lived in Dixon. We started off there. And then
you say we. Who's we?
Not me.
No, my wife and our two kids.
Okay.
At that time. And then we later divorced.
Lots of us have that stuff.
We divorced. She took one of the kids. I took the other. She went back to California, and I stayed.
Would you flip for it, or?
No, it was she took the girl and I took the boy.
Yeah. And it was often that. I'm kind of kidding, but it's usually kind of obvious.
And then I wound up in Long John's Valley, which was a hippie commune up by Ojo Zarco. And that's when I first started doing craft work and carving and so forth. And I was in the very first Peñasco Arts and Crafts fair that they had back in the late 70s. With my work, didn't sell anything, but had a lot of fun.
And, you know, especially here in Placitas with the villages or the place before the villages, people will say it was a hippie commune. For those of us who didn't actually see it with our eyes or any hippie commune, can you just go, oh, there's a hippie commune? Or is it just some artists or just people of like-minded kind of living cooperatively? Is it like a kibbutz in Israel?
More or less. It's, living cooperatively. There always seem to be kids involved, either single parents or families. Usually there were animals, chickens and pigs and goats and things. In our case, that we had pretty much every kind of animal in Long John's Valley. We farmed with horses, and horses were our main transportation. And we were like isolated down in this little valley on the Trompas River. And so you'd have to either walk in and out or ride the horse. And we had wagons, we'd bring our hay in, and in the wintertime we'd go out in the snow and go around and visit and so forth. But it was the distinction between a hippie commune and just a bunch of people living together is some kind of a commitment to the place and each other. And that we would work together, we would harvest together, plant together, work in the garden.
So it's kind of like an agricultural food co-op that we see cooperatives where, you know, it's not the same kind of commitment because you don't live in the store, but you know, you'll put in 10 hours and you'll get a little discount or something. It's all volunteer labor.
Right.
But on just a more grandiose scale.
And it all revolved around food. Everything that in the commune revolved around food. It was feeding us, feeding the kids, feeding the animals, and growing things to eat.
And what kind of living quarters did you all have? Did you build them yourself or take?
They were all built by the people. Now, when I got there, a lot of people had moved on, and it was some of the new people. Long John, the guy the valley was named after, was still there, and some of the other people that started, but they were all individual little cabins that were scattered around the valley. And I pretty much lived in every one of them at one time or another. As one of them emptied out, I'd go, oh, I think I'll live in this one for a while. So I'd take my son and we live in that. Now, we would have our individual cabins, and then we had one big house that we everyone cooked in and ate in and had our library, and we played music and the kids would play in and so forth. We're totally democratic. There was all decisions were made together. It was sort of a good training for the workers' cooperative, that all of us that were in the forestry workers' cooperative had some kind of experience living with other people. And so we brought that with us to the co-op, and the co-op made all of its decisions collectively.
And well, what kind of decisions would come up? Did you have a regular weekly meeting?
Well, we would have meetings daily to assess our progress on the contract, what our inspections were like, whether we were passing or failing, what we had to do to bring it up to full pay instead of getting a reduced pay on the job, whether we are being treated fairly by the Forest Service. Was there a claim due to the government for being treated unfairly? Was the contract size correct? Do we feel a remeasurement was needed? There were a lot of things that were day-to-day affairs of a business contractor that the crew of workers made the decisions.
With absolutely nobody with even 1% more voting power than anybody else.
That's right.
I would think you would eventually come to loggerheads on some things. Like, I don't want to grow corn this year. I want to grow cotton or something.
Discussions are spirited.
And we were all owners. So right. All owners of the company. And we did this for 20 years.
And was it formal enough that you actually were owners? You had B shares or preferred shares? Or
it was called Southwestern Forestry Workers Cooperative Incorporated. We were incorporated in the state of New Mexico as a workers' cooperative, and according to the statutes in New Mexico, we would disperse all the funds. There could be no profit that the company kept other than its capitalizing money for starting work, but that all the money went to the workers
It didn't get reinvested into new horses?
Well, we would buy tools. Okay. We would, a certain percentage off the top would go to the co-op, and they would buy the tools and do different things, and then most of the money would go to the crew, and then you'd have to deduct money that was used to perform the job, and then it got broken down into your hours, how many hours you had on it, and then so there was an hourly wage for that.
So this isn't just a bunch of drifters getting together and say, hey, let's hang out and grow stuff and have a good time. This was a business. It was just your social structure and maybe living conditions were different than some of the mainstream people.
That's right. And each worker had $1,000 invested in the company.
So there's a buy-in.
Yes.
So.
And when you leave, you got it back. So it wasn't like that's money that's not there.
But it didn't increase in value?
No.
No.
But it assured you of your standing in the company.
Right. But not even the, you know, like when you put a deposit down, even the power company gives you, 4% a year because they're holding your deposit. But mm-hmm. Nothing like that.
Nothing like
that. See, I'm such a capitalist.
No, that just gave you the privilege to work.
Okay. 20 years, that's a long time. Did you get like the proverbial 7-year itch? It's like, John, what are we doing? I don't know what we would be doing, but there must have been like bad harvests or cold winters where you kind of question your commitment.
Well, things happen. Now, you're talking about the commune rather than the co-op. Now, and that was the case that things did happen with the commune. Changes occurred regularly, and different people came along. At one point, all the women left, and that left nobody there but the men in the valley. There were like 7 of us guys.
There's got to be a story to go along with that.
They were just fed up with having to do all the work.
Okay.
Cooking, cleaning, and what are the guys doing? They're out riding horses.
So it was a justifiable grievance.
Oh, I was on their side. I stayed, but I was on their side. and they didn't hold it against me, and, we were always good friends. But there were also romantic entanglements there, which were inevitable because we were all young and healthy and of around the same age. So some of it was that I'm sick of you, I'm getting out of here.
Right. Well, yeah, that has been the source of many wars. And then at some point you left the cooperative also.
The commune and the co-op, yeah.
And were you living in Placidus at the time?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so how did you decide on what your residence was going to be? Or 35 years ago, there weren't a lot of choices. I mean, the home that you're still in,
mm-hmm.
How did you find it? Or that piece of land?
Well,
did they have realtors or?
It was all by word of mouth. And we were living in Llanito, which is down north of Bernalillo near Algodones. And a friend of mine said, hey, the house next door to me is up for sale. And the lady said, if you have any friends, they can have first pick. And there's a pond on it.
Wow.
So we went, whoa, okay. So we went and looked at it, fell in love, and we bought it. So
sure.
That was back in 1983. And we were in the co-op until 1997. So pretty much all the years that the holiday sale was going on, that was our other job.
Right.
It wasn't just the art. We couldn't make enough money on that. So
certainly.
It was seasonal with the tree planting. We planted trees in the springtime. So that was the time that we went out and to the woods, and we planted trees in all throughout New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, Utah. So we were in the 4-state area.
And you take like a backpack with a little pup tent or?
Well, everyone was different with their camping needs.
Right. I mean, you were not at one of these nice national park campsites.
No, we never camped in a campground. We always camped near where we worked.
So you must have come across wildlife, or wildlife must have come across you.
Quite a bit.
That's creepy.
Quite a lot. Bears, elk, just all kinds of wildlife.
An elk I don't feel terribly threatened by, but I probably should. I guess if I were smart enough not to approach it. But a bear or a mountain lion, they can be a little aggressive. They
Well,
at least mountain lions are carnivorous. Do they know that we don't taste good, or maybe we do taste good?
We had a mountain lion on our land the other day. So speaking of.
Here in Placidus.
Here in Placidus.
And so what do you do?
Well,
do you stay inside?
You know, yeah. We've had bear come up to us also at our place in Placidus, and we grabbed the dogs as fast as we could and got in the studio and then got the camera.
Got to get it on Facebook. you probably have edible fruit trees and things like that.
Yes,
so my understanding is only based on two or three comments I've heard from people is that we really don't get the bears unless there's not a lot of rain up in the mountains. Because why come down here if there's food up there?
Right.
Pray for rain.
Yes.
I understand over by Placidus Heights where the 4th of July parade starts, if you go down Camino del Carocito to Rincon or one of those names, there's a three-way stop, and people have seen a mountain lion kind of hanging out there in the mornings. Wait till afternoon to get your mail.
Look both ways.
Yes. Well, that's part of the fun. Well, we've spoken with some of the fish and game people and agricultural agents, and it just sounds like it's easy to get along as long as you're not really dumb about it. And there's no reason to say we're a higher life form, so you got to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Can't we all get along kind of thing. At some point, waterprisms.com became a reality. The Forest Service went away. The cooperative went away. The commune went away. And you are now full-time working artists.
Yes.
And most of your business are the water prisms?
On our website, probably mostly the water prisms. Mm-hmm. And also here in Placidus, but we tend to sell more of the other things here in Placidus, along with our water prisms.
And what are those other things?
Mandalas, pyramid lamps, jewelry boxes, sun catchers. We've got ornaments for your tree, smaller things.
Right. And I apologize to the KUPR folks, but we're going to look at a water prism here.
Okay.
Which...
And then we can look to see if there's any sun, and I can put some water in this.
Okay.
Would you like me to do that?
But we'll do that at the very end.
Okay.
But it is a five-sided piece of, it's like a five-sided pyramid, top and bottom, held together by rectangular pieces of glass. And then is that traditional lead solder, or that you see like in... stained glass windows?
We are now using a lead-free solder, which costs a lot more, but it's healthy, much more healthy for us. So it is stained glass process, but it has to hold water. So you have a challenge right there that you have pressure, and when you put the water in, there's pressure happening.
Certainly.
If there's any kind of gaps anywhere on any seams, then you're going to have a leak, and you don't want to see your prism leaking. So it's much more painstakingly careful with everything we do with the prisms. The prisms take longer to make.
Oh, certainly. I mean, you've got a lot of physics to deal with there. Were you doing stained glass before you were doing the prisms?
Well, no, not really. I sort of always loved glass, and I had a friend who was a glass blower, and he had learned about the concept. So he told me about it, and he showed me how to, he had some tools, and he showed me how to make one, and that was it.
So you could talk tools again.
Yeah, he showed me how, and then from there I just went on with it.
And is it, not to give away trade secrets, but is it some special techniques that you add on to the traditional stained glass to make it watertight, or?
Oh, yeah. Right. You definitely have to know a few things.
Okay.
A lot of people have tried to make them, and in fact, the stained glass shop in Albuquerque, they told me the story that their customers said, oh, we got to do some, we got to try this, and they tried. They couldn't get it to not leak.
Wow.
She said, well, I guess we'll send them to you.
So maybe we should talk about a patent or a trademark or something.
Yeah, it's hard to get a patent.
You're not kidding.
Something like that.
I'm not sure what value it does these days.
Yeah.
But
I wouldn't want to control all the water prisms and the rainbows in the world. It's something that's wonderful because it's so spontaneous and free.
Right.
And I think for anyone that can experience that, it's all good.
And it's ever-changing, you know, as the thing turns and the sun goes up and down. Or
yes,
rises
and another thing, they'll make moon bows from the full moon.
Oh, totally cool.
They will actually refract the full moon. They make these very light-colored, pastel-y colors. They're actual colors.
Right.
Very light in color. And it's all at night.
It's wonderful. All right, we have learned the backstage pass of the couches and the featured artists in this year's Placidus Holiday Fine Arts and Crafts Sale that is either happening or did happen on November 19th and 20th in the year 2016. And either go out and see it or hope you had a great time. I'm sure you did. So thank you both. It's very interesting. Oh, I did promise to ask. Nancy, when did you have your first green chili cheeseburger?
Well, when I first came to New Mexico, it was up in Cuba, and I had some green chili, and I never in my life thought that I would not explode any larger from that green chili. Now I love it.
And what? Where did you come from? What
part? California.
Okay.
Also.
John, your cheeseburger experience?
1971, Blake's Lotta Burger in Espanola.
It's funny. It's like the people remember, where were you when Kennedy was shot? When did you have your first chili cheeseburger? All right. For Conversations with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR 99.9 FM and abqlive.tv, thank you very much. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.